Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. My name's Ruth McKee and I'm the editor of Books Ireland. Joining me today is author and journalist Shane Hegarty. He's one of Ireland's most beloved writers of children's fiction, with best-selling series like Dartmouth and Boot to his name, and including his latest series, The Book of Impossible Ice Creams. Big Berry Robbery is the next book in this series and it's out now with Hachette.
I always like to ask people about what kind of books they were drawn to when they were children, you know, because it's where we always start off. And it's like the first question, really, if we're talking about your life in books, is what kind of reader were you as a little boy? And, you know, was there a book from that time that you remember?
Yeah. So, like, I was always a reader. And I would have, like, I remember really the first book I ever read that felt like something different and felt like a chapter book and felt like a proper book was Winnie the Pooh. And I would have read that when I was about 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old. And I remember, you know, being, you know, reading 30 pages on that first night. I remember, you know, and it felt like I graduated into something different and into a whole new world. So I would have had, like so many others, sort of the picture books, the, you know, the kind of the standard stuff up until then. Although, really, as a children's books writer, I see it myself now, like the range that's available now is so vastly different to what was available when we were younger. But Winnie the Pooh was really the first that marked something different. And really from there, I was always looking for something new to read. And I would have read, really, I'm trying, you know, it's kind of hard for me to remember exactly what kind of books I read up and between that and then Roald Dahl. And Roald Dahl was that moment where, I suppose, having read something which I still think it reads brilliantly, Winnie the Pooh now, and I still think it has kind of great charm and humor. And obviously those characters are such classic characters, and they carry something of the human condition around with them that you can read differently as an adult than when you're a kid. But I probably read quite sort of traditional stuff up until Roald Dahl, which the great thing about Roald Dahl is he kind of turned everything then on its head. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I read anything in which the characters were deliberately nasty. And in some cases, all the, you know, the main characters would be particularly dislikable. And so really that was my journey then, which was probably not an unusual reading journey as a, you know, I grew up in the 80s, really. And I'd say a lot of kids would have had a similar path. But then after that, you know, I read so much. I read a lot of detective books, the Hardy Boys, things that have kind of fallen out of fashion, really, at this stage. It was a series called The Three Investigators, Alfred Hitchcock and The Three Investigators. And these were, you know, and The Famous Five. And I would have read a lot of Enid Blyton, I suppose, as well, actually, now that I think about it. But like that, I think in those days, here we go now, we straight away into what it was, you know, oh, those days, I'm showing my age, but there was no kids' TV.
Yeah.
There weren't kids' movies, really. There weren't devices. So I would read everything. So, you know, I read Reader's Digests, you know, compilations that my grandmother had in her house. I read history books that my grandparents had in their house. I read magazines. I kind of read anything that was there. And I think I was a very voracious reader, but I think it was helped in a way in that that's really all you, well, you had that, or you could go outside, or you had Lego, which we had as well. But there were, you know, the possibilities of what you could do as a child in the 80s were sort of fairly limited compared to how they are now.
And it's weird as well, because we were talking about, you know, reading everything and anything, but, you know, and that children's books are kind of different now, and that maybe there's not that there's more prescribed things, but there's actually, you know, you can go for categories. You can say, I'm going for young adult, going from, you know, oh, my child is between 9 and 12. There's these books that are out now, and there's this that's recommended. And you go online, there's like, and it's all kind of tailored, and which is brilliant. But you're talking about growing up in an era where there just wasn't that kind of impetus either from, well, I don't know, maybe there was from publishers, but.
I don't think there was. No, there definitely wasn't. It wasn't as, you know, the way the children's books have changed in the last few years. I think if, you know, there's a, in some ways we take it for granted now that they're at the front of the shop. And if you walk into an Eason's now, you will see the books right there at the front of the shop. And they're the brightest, the most colourful, the most attractive. And there's a huge, there's a fight for attention there. But, you know, you go back 15 years and it wasn't like that. You go back 10 years and it probably wasn't like that. They've only really got to the front window now. So I don't think there was that same deliberate sort of strategizing that really goes into them now, and that segmentation. And maybe what it meant was that you were look, it's brilliant, and it's brilliant that there's so much range and there's a greater diversity of books and of characters within books, and increasingly a diversity of writers, which is really important as well. But when I was growing up, you kind of just read whatever was there. And sometimes it was, you would discover things simply because you've nothing else to do. As I said, if I was visiting my grandmother, who lived in the same town of Skerries where I am now, said she just, I remember those Reader's Digest compilations being a big thing. And I would, they were often full of stories of, especially the Second World War. I was Montgomery's Double, I think was one that I sort of remember now, where they would have Agatha Christie. Yeah. I can't remember whether it was, they would have short stories, or maybe it was a chapter or something, but there was, or, you know, about Agatha, when Agatha Christie went missing, you know, and there were, so you kind of found that I was reading these things, you were discovering things really by chance and by luck, and maybe because you didn't have that opportunity to go into a shop and go, you know, go for the thing that seemed right for you, you would just end up with things.
There wasn't like a desire line to anything. You just kind of, you could just find yourself way over in a field, you know.
Yeah. 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 And it's lovely. And I think that in a way, that's how a reading journey through life anyway, if you're a reader as an adult, it's brilliant still to pick up something and just discover things and to find things. And I do worry sometimes that is, it's lost as a reading possibility. I do feel that much as you sort of worry about what devices do to the brain and to you know, to people's attention and all of that, at the same time there is a huge discovery you can be made as well online, and you can, if you follow the right paths in terms of the, you know, quality and stuff and factual stuff, you can actually have that same journey on YouTube sometimes. But but for me, yeah, it was the printed word that I went on that journey, and still try now to have discoveries every now and again.
I kind of wonder what it would be like if, you know, if we were transported back then but had devices, you know. I often wonder about that. Would I, you know, would you still have been a reader? Would I still have been a reader? Or would we have found that just the way, like you were saying, would I just have been like on YouTube channels all the time? Or, you know, whatever was available for that thing that I was looking for, maybe it wouldn't have been a book, you know?
No, and look, I, the truth is there's a huge fall off in readers at the age of 12, 13. And I, you know, I'm not coming here armed with any facts now. So, but I don't think I'm wrong in saying that that's probably getting a bit earlier.
Yeah.
That fall off, because kids are getting devices earlier than they used to get. And you really, once you get into secondary school, and there's lots of other reasons as well, suddenly kids are reading because they have to read, because they have to read stuff and answer questions about it in a way that they didn't in primary school. It is a huge challenge to keep, as a parent and as a writer, to kind of keep kids reading. Boys are especially prone to stopping reading. And it's why as well you're seeing this great change towards more visual books. So a lot of illustrated books, a lot of graphic novels.
It's amazing. Man, and
that's also because there's a generation which is far more visual than our generation would have been. Their understanding of visuals is hugely sophisticated. Their understanding of TV and film and I'm always like, they love manga. The amount of times I'll go into a classroom and the kids know manga, which is not something I was in any way familiar with. So I grew up with Marvel comics and would have read a lot of Marvel comics, especially X-Men. There was a Secret Wars, which was a one of those crossover series where, in this case, all the superheroes and all the supervillains were sort of put on a planet together. And I grew up with those. And that, so it was, there was definitely visual storytelling, which, as we know, kind of turned into this monster that it is now in terms of the film franchise. So it's not as if it was missing when we were younger, but you look back at those books now and they're just a world away. Sorry, I mentioned Marvel, but if you look at the books that were coming out at the time, the standard kind of kids' novels, they're a world away from where they are now, where the visuals are a big part of it, down to often how the words will be presented, the graphics that are used in terms of presenting the story. So there is a melding of everything coming together.
Yeah.
And while we worry, that's a very middle-aged parent thing to say, but you look at how the impact of devices and tablets and the million channels, I'm saying channels, the streaming services, everything, at the same time, it's actually having a feedback effect then in terms of what books are doing. And in some ways, then that opens up books to kids who maybe would have struggled to read, or it might keep them reading longer because they'll read graphic novels, they'll read comic books, they'll read manga. So it opens up a whole other world there. So it's an interesting, there's a feedback loop going on there at the moment, which I think is definitely changing children's books as much as it's changing TV and film.
I was going to ask you about you as a teenager, and, you know, because it's one of those, I mean, you have a teenager, I have a teenager. So, you know, you kind of remember, you know, that what that's like in a way, you know, you have we don't really need to describe what that period is like, but what was it like for you? And did you stop reading? Did you have a lull, or was there something you gravitated towards, or what kind of got you through that stretch?
No, I never really had a lull. I didn't have a lull as a teenager. I definitely, when I think back again, like there was a bigger jump from what, primary school reading into effectively adult reading around that time. So now you have, as we've talked about, all those different kind of gradings of books. So, I mean, they literally call middle grade, which is that sort of 8 to 12 year old. And then they talk about, wouldn't it be great to, you know, there's often conversations about, well, what's there for 10 to 14 year olds? They're kind of on the cusp of.
Arbitrary and ambiguous as well, isn't it?
Like, but it is. And it's very hard to categorize anything, because I know that there can be great joy in a picture book when you're older. Everybody's different. Everybody reads differently, but there definitely wasn't the same amount of choice. So there wasn't a huge amount of, while there were books for what we now call young adults, I don't know whether we called them young adults at the time. And I would have, you know, for instance, I would have started reading, well, probably, I can't remember what age I read the Narnia books, probably a bit younger. You know, I would have read them. They were probably the first series I read, the first time I read a book where a series where what happened in one book had an impact on the next, which wasn't really the case with The Famous Five or The Three Investigators, The Hardy Boys. It would have an adventure. It would all be wrapped up neatly. And then you'd pick up the next one and nothing had really changed. Narnia was probably the first time, the Narnia books were probably the first of those types of books that we're so familiar with now. But I ended up very quickly reading, so there were a couple of readers or books around that time. Stephen King was one of those which a lot of teenagers would have read, and I discovered Stephen King at that age. But the big one for me was Douglas Adams, and I read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy probably at the age of about 14 or 15. And it just, again, I think in the way that Roald Dahl, there was that flipping of things on its head to an extent in the way that Roald Dahl wrote children's books. I think when I read, and I have The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy here with me now, I read that book and it just felt...
I know the listeners can't see the cover. I just want to... Yeah, great.
It's what Douglas Adams did with that book, which I don't know if it's fair to say, it's not being forgotten, because it's clearly not a forgotten book, but it's one of those books which I think maybe the success of it, the absolute extraordinary success of this book, the radio show, the TV series, just how much it impacted on culture at the time. And I probably saw the TV series first, the BBC TV series. But when I read this book, again, it was one of those where I suddenly realized there was a way to write science fiction. There was a way to write with imagination and with philosophy and everything, but also to have a joke on almost every other line. And I still, it's a book which I still go back to a lot. And I probably had a gap of maybe 10, 15 years where I didn't read it. And then I just rediscovered it as an adult.
Just looking at that and thinking, like, I know my brothers and sisters read it and it was sort of passed down as a kind of a, you know, it's like people quoting from it. You know, you would have, I'd love to hear you read a bit from it to see if it kind of brings, I haven't looked at it in such a long time.
And it's almost, so the first two books, this and The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, are, I think, almost perfect books in terms of plot, in terms of ideas, in terms of everything. The series itself it doesn't quite hold as strong, and in fact gets quite dark by the fifth book.
Right.
But the first two are fantastic. Now, so I have a kind of I've often said this. I've said it's one of those books where I can open up any page and read any line. It's like the first time I've ever read it. So I have the book here, and I didn't say I'm going to pick a passage. I'm going to literally open it and see where
you land.
We end up and see. I might completely, but like, you know, the Vogons were, he straight away, I open it up and the Vogons, now I read this, I'm going to regret doing this. Somewhere in a small dark cabin buried deep in the intestines of Prostetnik Vogon Jels's flagship, a small match flared nervously. The owner of the match was not a Vogon, but he knew all of them and was right to be nervous. His name was Ford Prefect. Now, straight away I go in there and I write, the Vogons are the ones who have the worst poetry in the universe. So this is where we get into, you know, there's a whole thing that it leads into from there. And Ford Prefect, of course, is the alien who happens to be Arthur Dent's best friend, and he doesn't realize he's an alien. So I have one probably failed to read the most exciting chapter in it, which is why I should have been more prepared than I had thought. You go, yeah, that should be an easy thing to do. Well, I'm now completely regretting that. But the gist of it is that every single page has an idea. Every single kind of chapter has an amazing. There, here we go. Like, I mean, I flipped onto a few pages now. You know, but an amazing idea or something which is almost about timeless and kind of immortal in terms of writing and fiction. Vogon poetry is, of course, the third worst in the universe. The second worst is that of the Asgoths of Crea. During a recitation by their poet master Grunthos the Flatulent of his poem Ode to a Small Lump of Green Putty I Found in My Armpit One Midsummer Morning, four of his audience died of internal hemorrhaging, and the president of the Mid-Galactic Arts Nobbling Council survived by gnawing off one of his own legs. So the thing about this is, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a lot of people have tried to write books like this, and I'm one of them, because I wrote Darkmouth, my first series, with a book within a book. But almost nobody, I don't think anybody has ever really come close to matching what he did. And I think that's the strength of it as well, is that it's such an unusual and rare book still, that it's both funny and profound. And there are very few writers that really had that ability that Douglas Adams had. And he does seem to me to have been one of those people who had a brain the size of a galaxy. Just happened, you know.
Or was it Marvin the Paranoid Android, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Marvin the Paranoid Android. Yeah. The you know, the answer to the life, the universe and everything. The, you know, the whole thing opens with Arthur Dent's house about to be demolished to make way for a bypass. And then he finds out the Earth is about to be demolished to make way for an intergalactic bypass. So every time you look at something, it's just idea after idea. And because Douglas Adams had this book within the book, which is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there are all these little offshoots where he'll just go off and tell a mini story within a larger story.
Yeah.
So it is so packed, and not a particularly long book. I mean, I'm looking at it here, and what, 179 pages? 179 pages, actually 180 pages. And apart from, as I said, me opening up and claiming that every single line was gold and then finding one which wasn't, it really is one of those that, as I said, every time I read it, I do feel like I've, it never gets old. It's like a song. It's like, a song that you can listen to over and over again, and it just never stops.
I'll have to go back and read that again. It'll bring back loads of my childhood, I reckon, as well. So it'll be quite moving. You know, when you kind of go back and you're like, oh, I remember.
And look, and the other thing I'd say is that I've met 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds who very rarely I meet them in schools, and they've read it and they love it. And despite the fact that it cut loads of jokes about 1980s bureaucracy and digital watches and things, they actually still love it. So it's worth putting it in the hands of a young reader and seeing what they think.
So you were talking there about funny and profound, which are two of the things I love to find in novels as well. But not particularly talking about novels here, but you know, you worked as a journalist, and maybe you still do work as a journalist sometimes. But I know you were formerly, arts editor of the Irish Times, and this is a huge part of your life. So, is there a writer that kind of can do, let's say, what Douglas Adams does in a book, but you know, with journalistic writing or with nonfiction and that kind of a thing that you would admire?
Yeah. So I, you know, in terms of those writers who, I think kind of, you know, you can say kind of changed my life to an extent, I would certainly put Clive James in there. So Clive James, I think we're so familiar with criticism now that crosses into humor, that tries to get at the heart of something, but with, you know, by taking this sort of almost surreal look at something. And you have brilliant examples of that at the moment in the likes of Patrick Frayne, who writes for the Irish Times.
Yeah.
Oh, he's absolutely brilliant. But Clive James was one of those early pioneers of it. His TV criticism in The Observer, again, kind of back in the, kind of around the 80s, I think maybe the 70s as well, it was just phenomenal. You read those columns and it's a great mark of his collected works that you can read. You could read those TV reviews of things you'd never seen and were never, ever going to see. And yet they still read brilliantly.
Yeah.
And Clive James is one of those writers who, I suppose, opened up my eyes as well to how you could examine something. In that case, TV, which was something I was big into writing about at the time. And I ended up being the TV critic of the Irish Times. And I was definitely informed by his approach to things. And I still write occasionally. I was writing for the Sunday Times up until recently, and I've been writing for the Irish Times again occasionally of late. And everything I do, both in journalism, not everything, but certainly there's a kind of an overarching approach to everything, or most of what I've done in journalism, as well as in the books that I now write, which is trying to find that balance between something which is a story and is interesting and is something to say occasionally, but also has a joke in it, also has humor in it, also, I suppose, kind of shows that a lot of this stuff isn't to be taken entirely seriously. So definitely the likes, you know, so when I talk about Douglas Adams in terms of his approach to fiction, definitely Clive James in terms of his approach to nonfiction. And also, he'd an incredible mind again, and somebody who was very interested in a range of people and subjects. Yeah. And everything he wrote just had that lightness of touch to it, despite the fact that it was intellectually very heavy.
But yeah, I know what you mean, like a kind of a just, I think it is that kind of curiosity that just brightens it. It's like a real sort of, not investigative, but what's the word I'm looking for, but yeah, that kind of,
yeah, it is, it's curiosity, really. It's infectious as well, because he wrote about things that I mightn't have, when you don't know anything about, you know, a person, he just illuminates them or a subject in a way that it's as much for the writing as the subject. And I think that's a very difficult balance to get. There are other writers I recommend for that kind of thing. Anthony Lane, who is written for The New Yorker. Nobody's Perfect is a great collection of his work from a few years ago that I'd really recommend. Nancy Banks Smith was a phenomenal critic for The Guardian who would have been especially good at writing about soap operas. Right. Coronation Street in its heyday. And so these have all really informed me. So when I write now for children, you know, you're writing stories that you're trying to make it an interesting story. You're trying to create interesting characters and settings, and you have to propel the story forward. But I'm always looking for that angle in which I can put a little kind of humorous twist on it, or put a joke in there, or find a, I suppose, just to constantly keep the reader on their toes as to what might happen next, or what might come in off the side of the page from, you know, a character or something that's happening there. So and I think definitely these are the writers that have informed that over the years.
Yeah. What about, I'm just thinking of your own books there, but I know you have children, but do you have any beta readers in your house then, particularly with humour? Is there like, no, Dad, that's not going to work?
Yeah, no, definitely. I find that, I have 10-year-old twins and a 12-year-old daughter, and I have a 17-year-old son. And I do occasionally get them interested in reading my stuff in advance. Part of the problem is they see printed out A4 pages with no pictures on them, and it's not the same. What I will do, certainly, you know, Quiva, my 12-year-old, was when she was a bit younger, was brilliant when I wrote a series called Boot, which is a 3-book series about a robot, toy robot that wakes up in a grinder about to be mashed into a million pieces. And she would have read that, and I got brilliant feedback, just a sense of how it was working in terms of whether she got the story and whether she was engaged by the story. And that's where, you know, I kind of like to say that my job in life is to ruin children's bedtimes, because you want them to get to the end of a chapter and want to know what happens next. Right. And we often, at events and at schools and in libraries, we talk about who are the secret readers and how they read secretly when they're supposed to have their light off at night. So it does give me a sense sometimes when I do that, when I get them to have a read, when I get, you know, one of my daughters to have a read, whether they want, I'll give it to them in small amounts, so they'll get a chapter. And do they want to know what happened? Do they ask for the next chapter instead of giving them dumping a ream of A4 pages?
Do corrections in red pen, please.
Yeah. The best bit is very occasionally when they say to you, it's like a real book, which means it's not like their dad has written it.
Your book.
That's always a good sign. And I have a picture book out next year, which I have a kind of a printed out version of here. And one of my daughters said, did you do these rhymes? Because they're kind of very good. So if I can surprise them, then I feel I'm doing okay.
Oh, that's great. Okay, I've got a horrible question, and I know people sometimes don't want to answer it. Sometimes they can't wait to answer it. it's about it's burning, but it's just not great. But still, is there a book that you would leave in your house to burn?
You see, it is such a tough question, because I used to write book reviews every now and again, and obviously I was a TV critic, and I would have reviewed other things, like, you know, occasionally theatre and film. And I've got very soft now because I know how bloody hard it is to make something. So my answer to that is I think this is a real cop out answer, so I apologize in advance for copping out. But if I was leaving things behind, if I was to leave a book behind or books behind, it's definitely those that, I suppose, there are those books within on the shelves, right, on the bookshelves, that maybe are written for more cynical motives, or maybe have a name on them that isn't necessarily the name of the person who wrote the book, or maybe are written by people who are writing for a readership that they don't particularly care about. They care more about whether it's their brand or the money that comes with it. And look, that's the way of the world. I'm not naive about these things. But I suppose if I was leaving books behind, it would be that kind of book. And I think I'm not going to, you know, say the names of any books or any writers or anything, but I think we all know, and especially people either who love books and read books regularly, or like a particular genre of book, or maybe, you know, again, who are reading a lot of children's books, you know, those books that are not written with the sort of heart and love and effort and sincerity that so many great writers do put into it and maybe are overlooked because because there's there's a flood of other type of books out there. So I'm not just talking about the children's books world. There are other, you know, that's across a lot of the books world, and it's a huge debate that goes on within children's books and within other areas about the merits or otherwise of that and how it brings readers in or cuts readers off from other things or whatever it might be. But I suppose occasionally you might see an author or meet an author especially, and you realize they don't really care that much about the world in which they're supposedly inhabiting. So I'd be quite happy to leave their books behind.
Let's leave all of those behind, and let's leave the cynicism that goes with it behind too, and it's going up in flames. Now, this is a nice question to finish off with, and this is about taking something from the house that isn't a book, but that's important. Yeah.
So I have it if I was to find it in the drawer here now. But my look, I presumed that in this we don't include. Obviously, I'll take all the baby pictures and all that kind of stuff.
That's all a given.
That's all a given. But my my parents moved house about 3 or 4 years ago now. Everything is before the pandemic. So before the pandemic, and my mother took out of the drawer in the house a watch that my granduncle, her uncle, had, and he would have worn it until he died relatively young. I never knew him, and I have a real interest and a real sort of fascination about watches, and there's something about their ability to tell a story, I think, as well as the time. They last. If they're mechanical watches, they're the kind of things that they outlive their owner, and they can kind of go on, and you can wear something that was literally beside the heartbeat of the person who had it before. Mm. And we took this out of the drawer, and it's just a simple little kind of time only watch, but it worked straight away, and it had not been used for 50 years. Now, it didn't tell the time particularly well, but I got it serviced very easily, and have it now, and can wear it to kind of family occasions, and it's just one of those things that there's a man who, you know, was part of our family story, who none of my generation ever met within our family, and yet this watch, which was by his, you know, which was on his wrist pretty much up until he died. I don't know. I find that something very. I just love the story of that. I love the way that they carry those stories, and what was really interesting as well was when we put it on. Now I have it here at the moment. It's not the original strap because the leather strap would have been dried and cracked. But actually, when I first got it, and I kept the strap since, when I put it on my wrist, even as it was in danger of kind of snapping and breaking because it hadn't been used so long, it was the same shape as my own wrist. So. There was something about that connection, that it can instantly close the gap of 50 years between you and somebody else. So so that's the thing. I just I treasure this, and it feels, it's one of those things which, as I said, just there's a story in it, and I think it's nobody will be passing on their mobile phones to their kids or their Apple Watches to their kids, and I still think there's something very special in an old mechanical watch and the stories that it can hold.
It really is. That's beautiful, Shane. Thanks for sharing that.
That's all right.
Well, I don't know if you are up to reading a little bit from your own, but before I let you head on, and if you are, if you have, so you can't find your own book there.
I have to find my own. Hold on, I had it here a minute ago. Hold on, yeah.
You have a look around there.
I have it here.
If you are going to read a wee bit first, would you let everybody know just before you read a little bit of the background? To the series, and I'm just going to say thank you now so that we can just hear your lovely tones singing us out. So it's been really nice to talk with you this morning, and thank you for coming on Burning Books.
It's been brilliant. I've loved it. It's really good. I feel like I could do this all day now, talking books.
Brilliant.
So a few years ago I was in Germany, and I had a thing called spaghetti ice, and spaghetti ice is is spaghetti ice cream, basically. And it's big in Germany, but it looks like spaghetti bolognese, but it's actually ice cream. And I go and I show the picture to kids when I'm doing events, and it kind of blows their mind because it literally looks like spaghetti bolognese. And when you eat it, you still think you're going to taste all the pasta and the meat, and then it turns out to be strawberry sauce and ice cream and everything. And at the same time, I'd often talked about ice cream thanks to my first series, Dartmouth, where the local ice cream shop, Storm in a Teacup, made an ice cream based on that book. And then during the pandemic, I just thought, well, do you know what? I'm going to write about something that's fun and silly and enjoyable and that kids love. And ice cream was the thing, and impossible ice cream flavors thanks to spaghetti ice. So this is how I came up with the Shop of Impossible Ice Creams. And it's about a boy called Limpet whose mother opens this ice cream shop. And there is an evil villain called Mr. Fluffy, who has amazing ice cream and a disco ice cream van, but hates children and he wants to crush their ice cream shop. And I thought I would just simply read a little bit. It's a short bit from the very first chapter of the first of what are the two books that are out in the series at the moment. And there's a third coming in the summer. The first thing to know about Limpet is that his favorite ice cream was vanilla. There was nothing dangerous about vanilla ice cream. Nothing that might jump out and attack you. Whatever might attack you from an ice cream, you ask. Limpet knew every way an ice cream might attack you. He had written them all down in his notebook of things that might go badly wrong. A chocolate flake might go up your nose and poke your brain. Strawberry sauce might cause a wasp to get stuck in your lip. And then another wasp might attack you to rescue its wasp friend. Sprinkles might make you sneeze really loudly, and Limpet's one wobbly tooth might fall out in the sneeze and rocket up someone's nose, and that person would have to live with a tooth up their nose for the rest of their life. And no, vanilla would do just fine for Limpet. Nothing could go wrong with vanilla. Oh, unless it was vanilla in a cone. Cones always got soggy bottoms and dripped on the ground, and Limpet could slip and fall. He did like other ice creams. His mum loved making them, and he enjoyed helping her. Together, they had made raspberry ripple, tutti frutti, rocky road, and tuna and celery. Okay, he didn't like tuna and celery ice cream too much. So there you go. That is a little, just a small flavor. There's my pun of the day, of the Shop of Impossible Ice Creams. And it's got ninja fairies, and it has a magic fairy fort and a roundabout, and it has an evil little sister called Eve, and it has a chicken called Curtis, and it's clearly a very serious book with very serious in it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Shane.
You've been listening to the lovely Shane Hegarty reading from his new book, Big Berry Robbery, which is out now with Hachette. Join me next time when I'll be talking to the one and only John Banville. See you all then.